This week we're in book five of Confessions. And I want to start off by reminding you where we were at the end of last lecture. At the end of last lecture, I was driving home one of the points which I think really undergirds Confessions, namely Augustine's central point, or one of his central points, is that our fundamental problem is that we cling to the created rather than the creator. As we've heard from the very beginning in book one, Augustine sees idolatry as being at the very root of our human restlessness. And now again, at the beginning of book five, in Augustine's prayer to God, he gives us the way to find true rest, to find peace, in the midst of our restlessness. Augustine writes this, he says, "Supported by these things you have made, let the human soul rise above its weariness." He's saying these things that you have made, which of course is everything we see, from friends to fried chicken to everything in God's creation, God has made in support so that we might rise above these things. And Augustine continues here, he says, "And pass through these creatures to you who have made them so wonderfully." Augustine is saying the things in this world that we see are good things. They have been made wonderfully by God. But for Augustine, he's saying we must learn to pass through them. These are, we might say, windows that we see through, not to simply look at, but to see through. And once we learn to see through them, to see the hand of the Lord, to see God, that's where we find refreshment in Him. That's where we find, as Augustine says here in the opening paragraph, that's where we find true strength, in the giver of these gifts, not in the gifts themselves. Friends die, as we were reminded in book four, and we've seen as we saw how Augustine was wrestling and lamenting over his friend's death. Friends will also fail you. Friends in themselves aren't eternal. Whether we're talking about friends, or talking about good food, or we're talking about family, these are good things, but they will not offer you the full internal embrace that you're looking for. For Augustine, we are looking for love, and we should be looking for love, but we're looking for it in all the wrong places. And in those other things, we cannot find the medicine to heal our restless hearts. And so at the beginning of this chapter, Augustine poetically calls us back to God. This is what he says. He says, "Let them turn back and seek you, for you do not forsake your creation as they have forsaken their creator. Let them only turn back. See, there you are in their hearts, in the hearts of all those who confess to you, who fling themselves into your arms and weep against your breast after their difficult journey, while you so easily will wipe away their tears. At this they weep the more, yet even their laments are matter for joy, because you, Lord, are not some human being of flesh and blood, but the Lord who made them, and now make them anew and comfort them." This life of ours is difficult. It's a difficult journey. Augustine is not selling us here on a health, wealth, easy life version of Christianity. But he does want to introduce us to who we're supposed to be journeying to. He's pointing us to our destination in this book by mapping out his journey for us. And so here in book five, he's the bishop. Augustine the bishop is dropping back into the narrative of where he left off, of where he was as a young man, both spiritually and geographically. from where we left off in book four. Geographically, Augustine is in the important African city of Carthage teaching rhetoric. Spiritually, he tells us here that he was roaming, quote, away from myself and could not even find myself, let alone you, end of quote. Augustine's telling us he was disintegrated, both from who he was meant to be, from his true self, and from God. Augustine is still lost, and he wants us to see throughout this chapter that while he's pointing back to this time as a young man when he was lost, he's also showing us now how he sees that God was providentially guiding him. God is using, Augustine tells us, even Augustine's own sinful deeds, and he's using even non-believers to lead Augustine home. And the first person in this book that God uses to direct Augustine's journey is Faustus. We see this character Faustus, the Manichaean bishop. Augustine tells us at this point he's 29, and he finally gets to meet Faustus. Augustine, as we know and has been pointed out at this point, is brilliant, and he was not only brilliant, but he read widely. And in Augustine's brilliance and his search for truth that Cicero helped put him onto, he's been discovering some problems with the Manichaean teachings. They made certain scientific claims that just didn't seem right as Augustine investigated them. And yet when Augustine would raise these questions and he would talk about these problems to the Manichees, they would tell him, hey, you just need to talk to Faustus. Faustus is brilliant. He's the teacher you need. He is the Manichaean bishop that will answer these questions and solve your problems. Well, in book five, Faustus comes into town. He shows up into Carthage, and Augustine gets to spend some time with him. And he tells us he likes him. He finds that he's a likable man, and he says he's quite the rhetorician himself. He could string words together, and he could do it with beauty. He had an attractive style, and Augustine the rhetorician appreciates this. But Augustine realizes that not only was Faustus not actually as well-read as Augustine was already at this point in his late 20s, but that Faustus didn't have any answers for Augustine. One of the things that we see here in book five is Augustine begins to be able to separate form or style from content. Remember earlier when Augustine, when it was in his late teens, he picked up the Bible to give it a shot, and he judged it lacking based on the style. Augustine was trained to judge things by the style and by the form rather than the content. And now it seems Augustine is starting to be able to separate style and form from the truth of the claims someone's making. Faustus was elegant, but all his elegance couldn't hide the problems with the content. And when Augustine asked questions, Faustus, to his credit, didn't try to hide that he didn't have solutions to these problems. He admits he doesn't know, and Augustine actually tells us he liked him more because of his transparency. He appreciated that Faustus didn't try to act as if he had these answers. But still, this left Augustine disillusioned and discontent with the Manichees. He began to realize that behind the claims of a kind of rationalistic certainty and behind their mockery of faith, and the claims of the church, that The Manichees were the ones actually making blind leaps of faith. And Augustine wants us to see how God used this false teacher to turn Augustine away from this false belief system. And what we'll see in a few minutes in this lecture and in this book is that Augustine not only used this false teacher, but he even uses Augustine's lustful ambition and desire for comfort to lead him to another bishop that would also impact him, but in a rather different way. So here we are. Augustine is in Carthage. He's in this famous African city, but he is about to geographically move closer to power. He's in order to advance his career, to find to get a better teaching job, and in hopes of finding better students, he moves to Rome, or at least he wants to move to Rome. But there's a problem. He has to figure out how to escape the hoverings of a helicopter mom and his mother, Monica. And in this chapter, Augustine recounts what happened, and this passage is worth citing. So listen to how Augustine puts this. The same night I left by stealth, she did not, he's speaking of Monica, of course, but remained behind praying and weeping. And what was she begging of you, my God, with such abundant tears? Surely that you would not allow me to sail away. But in your deep wisdom, you acted in her truest interests. You listened to the real nub of her longing and took heed of what she was asking at this particular moment. For you meant to make me into what she was asking for all the time. So the wind blew for us and filled our sails, and the shore dropped away from our sight as she stood there at morning light, made with grief, filling your ears with complaints and groans. You took no heed, for you were snatching me away, using my lusts to put an end to them, and chastising her too carnal desire with the scourge of sorrow. Like all mothers, though far more than most, she loved to have me with her, and she did not know how much joy you were to create for her through my absence. God is answering Monica's prayers here, will answer Monica's prayers, but not in the way that Monica had imagined. In desperation, she wants to stay close to Augustine, but God was using Augustine's sinful ambitions and his disregard for his mother in favor of his own career to actually answer Monica's prayers. I think part of our problem is what really was Monica's problem at the time. And that's in our pride. We can't accept that God's creativity is beyond our grasp. We pray to God and we expect Him to answer in our own way, on our own terms. But it's God's creative providence that we see in Augustine's story. God uses a Manichaean bishop and even Augustine's own idolatry to lead to the conversion of the most important theologian in the history of the church. When Augustine arrives in Rome, he's hanging out still with the Manichees. And you might be surprised by this, but it's really understandable. I mean, he tells us he couldn't find anything better, and this is the group he knew. This is the group he had contacts with. And so even though he didn't really find their teachings credible, this was the group he was with when he's in Rome. Augustine, at this time, he tells us, he was really hung up on many of the same things that we heard about in a previous lecture when it came to Christianity. For him, Christianity really wasn't an option, even though he had decided he couldn't really be a Manichaean anymore. And that was for one, because he pictured this Christian idea of humans being made in God's image as meaning that God has a physical body, that God had fingers and nails and hair. And Augustine just found this problematic. Augustine also couldn't make sense of evil in the world, but particularly evil in a world created by a good God. So he kept thinking about evil as a substance, as if God, knowing that, okay, if God created all things, then Augustine's thinking, well, then that means he created this substance of evil, and that doesn't seem to fit what the Christians are claiming about a good God. So this was a big problem for Augustine. And it's during this short time in Rome that Augustine becomes what he calls an academic skeptic. We might call this Augustine's brief agnostic period. The skeptics that he was attracted to during this period, he says, recommended universal doubt. It wasn't so much that they were saying that there wasn't truth, but they were saying, there's truth, but we as humans don't really have access to it. And so he's turned away from the Manichees, but he hasn't turned to Christianity. He's in this skeptical period, spiritually speaking, or philosophically speaking. And as far as his career goes, he has come to Rome in hopes of finding a better teaching post and, quite frankly, better students. And the students were better in Rome, but we find out there's this other problem that Augustine did not like. And that's, even though the students were better, they would get to the end of a course and the students would skip out on paying. And obviously that was something that irritated Augustine, as it would irritate any teacher. And so he ends up being offered a job in Milan, and Augustine takes it. Now, Rome was obviously the legendary city of the Roman Empire, but by this point, Milan was actually the center of power. This was where the emperor lived. And he would take the job as a master of rhetoric, working for the emperor as a kind of speechwriter. Augustine, the kid from the backwoods of the empire, has made it all the way to Milan, and he's in the center of power. His career seems to be peaking. But little did Augustine know at the time, things were about to change for him. Unbeknownst to Augustine, the hound of heaven was after him. And he now, once he arrives in Milan, would bring another bishop into his life. The first half of book 5 centers around this meeting with Faustus, this meeting that turns Augustine away from the Manichees. And now in the second half of book 5, Augustine meets Bishop Ambrose. And through Ambrose, God will turn Augustine towards Christianity. Ambrose is a significant figure in his own right. Historically, we know this. Very significant theologian and pastor. He's an important ecclesial figure in Milan and in the empire. He's a deeply learned man, and he was influential in public life. And I think that's important context when we get context for us as we get into this chapter, part of the chapter, because Augustine tells us this. He says, this man of God welcomed me with fatherly kindness and showed me the charitable concern for my pilgrimage that befitted a bishop. I began to feel affection for him, not at first as a teacher of truth, for that I had given up hope of finding in your church, but simply as a man who was kind to me. In other words, Ambrose was an incredibly busy and important man. And remember, despite Augustine's prodigious learning and success in climbing the career ladder, Augustine was an outsider to Milan. He still spoke with an African accent, which I guess is kind of like showing up with a South Georgian drawl to teach at Harvard. There's no escaping the fact that Augustine is not from these parts. And yet, the great Ambrose, Augustine recounts, was kind to me. Ambrose's kindness left an impression with Augustine. We might call this a kind of unapologetic kindness, which should be the mark of any true Christian apologetic. But Ambrose was not just kind to Augustine. Augustine would go on and tell us that he went to hear Ambrose preach to see if he lived up to his reputation as a great rhetorician. And he tells us this, quote, "With professional interest, I listened to him conducting disputes before the people, but my attention was not the right one. I was assessing his eloquence to see whether it matched its reputation." Again, it seems that old habits died hard for Augustine, and he's come here to not necessarily get truth. He's back at it again. He's back at judging. His intent is to judge this and judge Ambrose by his style, by his form. He's come on a kind of field trip, a kind of field experiment, and he wants to see if the eloquence that Ambrose was said to have was just kind of faint praise, or he really was a master rhetorician. And well, Augustine was not disappointed with what he heard. Ambrose lived up to his reputation. But the problem for Augustine was that while he was not listening for content, he was listening for the form. But the problem was the way Ambrose spoke, the content was actually tied to the eloquence of the form. So that for Augustine, who was a skeptic and wasn't looking for the church to give truth, he began to be open towards the truth. The truth and the eloquence was tied together. He says this, "I was taking no trouble to learn from what Ambrose was saying, but interested only in listening to how he said it, for that futile concern had remained with me. Despairing as I did that any way to you could be open to humankind. Nonetheless, as his words, which I enjoyed, penetrated my mind, the substance which I overlooked seeped in with them, for I could not separate the two. As I opened my heart to appreciate how skillfully he spoke, the recognition that he was speaking the truth crept in at the same time, though only by slow degrees. At first, the case he was making began to seem defensible to me, and I realized that the Catholic faith, in support of which I have believed nothing could be advanced against Manichaean opponents, was in fact intellectually respectable." So Augustine at this point begins to think, well, maybe. Just maybe. And in fact, at the end of book 5, he tells us that he wasn't a Christian yet, but he's open. He seems to, he's still in this kind of skeptical stage, but we might call him an open skeptic. And he enters into this formal stage of seeking. Ambrose, not only with his words, but with his life, made Christianity plausible for Augustine. And it seems to me that if you're a Christian listening to this, we should follow Ambrose. It's our job is not simply to prove Christianity. In fact, it's not to prove Christianity at all in the way that one might prove a math equation, but rather our role is to show others how Christianity works with our lives, to be people of kindness to others. And not simply, though, to show people how Christianity works with our lives, but to explain how it works with our words. That's what Ambrose does. God uses that in Augustine's life to make Christianity plausible. And as we jump into the following books, we'll see how the Lord continues to providentially use people in Augustine's life to draw him home and to bring him to true rest and to true love.